Reckless Eric is our guest on the World Cafe today, and he was one of the first signings to Stiff Records in 1977. His song Whole Wide World, produced by Nick Lowe, was a hit in the growing punk circles of the day. His drunken antics on stage and off during the Stiff tours of the U.S. and elsewhere gave a rollicking sense of what rock and roll was all about, but they took their toll on Eric, who joins us today wiser and as completely entertaining as ever. We'll find out whatever happened to Reckless Eric, but first, let's get the backstory. I ask Eric about where he grew up in England.
They moved to a little seaport called New Haven, which was like it had a cross ferry terminal where you could sail over to France, and it had a fishing fleet and a little fishing boat and the Valentine Pen Company, which then was bought up by the American company Parker Pen. And Parker Pen Company was New Haven. Most of the people that lived in New Haven either worked on the docks, on the cross channel ferries, or at the Parker Pen Company. And my dad worked there all his working life. Oh. We lived in a little house. I was born in a house 3 doors up from the factory opposite the railway station.
And there's a description of the wireless you had, the radio you had. I believe it was a Bush?
No, the record player later on was a Bush. The radio was a Bakelite radio, and it was all repaired with sellotape. I hated the radio because my dad used to listen to the news 3 times a day, and like we had to be quiet while he listened to it. Yeah. And he would always go, shh, like that. And I was always very upset by that. But then I pulled it down on my head one day when I was young, and it was always repaired with sellotape. And I always wondered if I'd suffered some kind of brain damage from that, you know. And I looked at the sellotape, and I always used to think, even when I was 15, 16, I used to wonder. But it was 1962, and they bought this Bush like record player, and you open the lid, you know, one of those little ones playing 45s on. And then I started buying records, and it changed my life. Well, by 1963, I was 9 years old, and the Beatles had come along. I started listening to music, really listening to it, and buying records just before the Beatles, and then it was all Telstar, Joe Meek, you know, the Tornadoes. And by the age of 9, I decided that the only thing you could be in life would be a pop singer. But I kept very quiet about it because I thought people would laugh at me, you know, because everyone else wanted to be a fireman or a soldier or something. I don't know what they wanted to be.
Reckless Eric is our guest today, and it's funny, you just mentioned the name Joe Meek, and you have a song about Joe.
Yes, I do. Yeah, I was always fascinated because he made records in an apartment in what we call a flat in the Holloway Road in London, and it was like the spare room. He coated the walls with shellac until it was hard, and put a microphone in there and a speaker, and that was his echo chamber. And he recorded groups in one of the other rooms, and had microphones up and down the stairs and all kinds of tricks, guitar amplifiers in the bathroom. And he made better sounding records than what came out of, because you know, in those days the top studios, they were used to recording an orchestra and a featured vocalist. They didn't really know how to record pop records, but he was a pioneer of pop. My first ever record that I bought was a Joe Meek record, and I actually thought it was not possible to separate the sound of that record from the sound of the record player. I couldn't imagine how it worked. It fascinated me.
Was the Joe Meek record that you bought first, was it Telstar or was it another one?
Globetrotter. They'd sold out of Telstar. Which was it was not Rubber Ball. It was one of Venus in Blue Jeans. Venus in Blue Jeans, Mona Lisa with a palm. It's exactly that tune, in fact. Mm. But then I wrote this song about Joe Meek, and would you like me to play it?
Sure would.
On the second floor of number 304, above a handbag store and the heavy roar
of traffic rolling down the Holloway Road. A one-time bedroom house and studio of Joe Lee. Where it conjured with the sound of another well. The Tin Pan Alley bomb was too absurd. The miles of wire and recording tape. For fortune, fame and no escape for Joe Lee. As he stirred up the sound of a hurricane, Joe Meek called upon forces from beyond the grave. Joe Meek suffered alone for his madness and pain. The only rewards that the hit parade held in store for Joe Meek.
Joe Meek, Reckless Eric, is our guest today on the World Cafe. I was in kind of getting ready to talk to you. I was looking back over things, and I was looking back at your first album cover. And the thing that a lot of things get communicated on that album cover. But one thing that struck me, and I think, is you look so darn enthusiastic.
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, but the whole thing was a laugh. That was the great thing about it, was that we weren't serious about it. And I hear this thing now. People are always talking about my career.
Right.
Your career, his career. I mean, we were doing it because we didn't want a career. It was of no interest at all. I mean, I always thought there was that record that came out at that time called The Right to Work by Chelsea, and I'm going, why? We don't want a job. We're doing this because we wanted to be slackers. We wanted to sort of undermine everything, like poke fun at it. And I always felt that my first album cover was severely misunderstood. I don't know what. Tell me what it communicates to you.
Well, they tried to make you look like you were a little reckless. You know, they what does your button say?
It says, I'm a mess.
Yeah, I'm a mess. And you know, your clothing is a little off the wall.
It's a little.
Yeah.
But
I was trying to get beyond that and look kind of at you. And I really got this whole enthusiasm, which I think. Seems to me to be really what you were all about at that point.
Yeah, well, the other
naivete,
thing, yeah,
maybe.
I mean, I came out of art school,
mm-hmm.
and when I was at art school, and particularly the art school that I went to, was very big on conceptual art, and it was always the concepts with me, and like, I thought, well, they want pop. They want pop, and I thought the whole idea of pop was so ludicrous. And I love the throwaway thing about pop, that you would do it and it was for the moment, and that was. But some of it then got this iconic status, you know? It's like Warhol and the soup cans or something. But
well, it's funny you talk about disposability, because in many ways those little disposable things like songs, and I'm thinking of Whole Wide World, end up living on in kind of an odd way, become the thing. And I understand Whole Wide World is going to be a tribute to the song, right? An album?
Whole Wide World is actually being recorded now by all these top bands. Everyone's sort of coming out of the woodwork to say, I always love that song. The Proclaimers are recording it. The Wedding Present have recorded it. Gemma Hayes has just recorded it and is doing it in a live set. I've got a manager in England who's masterminded all this, and he's just got us a deal on it. It's coming out on Stiff Records.
Oh, that's funny. Well, how do you feel about that?
Well, I feel good about it. Stiff Records has been bought by ZTT. That's Trevor Horn from the Buggles and all, Video Killed the Radio Star. Right. And they've been really good since they've had it. They licensed it out, and I wasn't really happy about some aspects of the re-release that they did a few years ago. But they were actually in agreement with me that it wasn't really what they wanted, but it was the best that they could do at the time. Mm. But they're going to relaunch it all. They've got the licensing rights back. They asked me to write my own sleeve notes. They've come to me and said, is this the right master? Because there was all stuff coming out that had been tinkered with, speeded up to make it sound more kind of poppy or something. For a new thing to come out on Stiff as well is a very positive thing, because a lot of people walked away from that with a very bad taste. You know, I didn't feel good. I never got paid. I never got a record royalty check till 1996. And that was like, you know, 20 years to get a royalty check. I never want to negate parts of my life. If you start to slag it all off and then you start to hate the records that you made and everything and despise that time that you spent, it's an awful waste of your life. You should treasure your life. It's all you got.
Of course, you know where I'm leading.
What?
Can we get a definitive World Cafe version of it?
Of what?
Whole Wide World.
It's a difficult one for me to play. I sometimes do another one, which is called Reconnaissance.
Excellent.
Which I kind of find, Whole Wide World, I always feel the record is so good, I only ever feel that I'm doing a rough sketch of it. And if you want to hear that, you should play the record.
Let's play the record.
Yeah.
We'll do that, and then you can do...
Make sure you play the right mix. And you won't. No, their version came out that was speeded up into... Because Whole Wide World, I'll demonstrate it. It goes like... When I was a young boy. Like that, right? Now, what they did, they speeded it up like this. So they put it up a semitone. So faster, you see. Loses the sexy groove. When I was a young boy. You see what I mean? It's no good, is it? It's not. That's what you want. As I say, I can only ever approximate that one, so I'll approximate another one instead.
Absolutely.
This was my second single, which I kind of like, but was very misunderstood in a way by me as well, because when I wrote it, I couldn't speak French, being an idiot and young and stuff like that, I never let it stand in my way. On a convenient seat by the lavatories in the sodium glare, we used to wait for the bus in a passionate clutch and go as far as we dared. Do you remember when I passed my driving test? I took you to the pictures, forget the rest. Do you remember all those nights in my Zodiac? When with your dress underneath your pack of Mac, of Recone Sherry, Connors haven't been on ecstasy. Recone Sherry, Connors haven't been on ecstasy. Recone Sherry, Connors haven't been on ecstasy. So French, the bohemian dream, you said bonjour mon ami. Do you remember when I moved into my studio flat? Hot sticky nights in the summertime in Betsy Land. Do you remember when you saw your paintings down the gallery? You said, may we ce soir, or say la vie, says to the tricolor, the tricolor, okay, oh, Recone Sherry, Connors haven't been on ecstasy. Recone Sherry, Connors haven't been on ecstasy. Oh, Recone Sherry, Connors haven't been on ecstasy. Yeah.
Reckless Eric is here. Recone Sherry. Me mangling his mangled friend.
It doesn't actually. You see, when I wrote it, I kind of like, I had this idea about French, and it all this. There was a lot of French people around when I was young because the seaport stuff, you know, right. And people working on the ferries and everything. I was always fascinated because we never went there. I mean, it only took 4 hours to get there on a boat, but it was. It was inconceivable that you would actually think of going there, but French people, sailors and people came over, and it was a bit of a French thing. And so when I wrote it, it was about growing up and stuff, you know, about dating and, sort of, you know, fumblings with girls in bus shelters and stuff.
Absolutely. Now, when did you move to France?
But the French didn't actually make sense.
No.
It did to me. Yeah, I actually moved to France, yeah, in 1989. I'd been, like, I was ill for a while. I had a nervous breakdown. And when I got better, I kind of thought, I don't know why I'm living in England, because it just depressed me. We had Margaret Thatcher at the time, and things were kind of a bit troubled, and there was nothing. Everybody I knew was unemployed. I didn't know anybody who had a job, apart from my dad, you know. And I was just kind of ups and left one day.
What did you end up... I know you did some playing out when you worked in...
I was playing all the time. Apart from when I was ill for a year, I was always playing different bands, different things. And
right.
Yeah.
And then what... where are you living now?
I live in Norfolk in England now.
Okay. So you're not like a tax exile or anything?
Well, yeah, possibly. I don't know. No, I mean, they were into me for a bit of money, which I couldn't afford to pay them, but it was a putrid amount, you know. I mean, I'm kind of like, I'm a musician. I live hand to mouth, you know. It's how we do.
Right. No,
I'm not a taxi. I lived in France for 9 years. I kind of was then, because I was bankrupted for money that I actually didn't see, that I never had any idea that I'd earned, but it seemed I had earned it, and I was bankrupted for it. I saw out the bankruptcy in France. I figured it was better to do that than... work myself into the ground to pay something like the tax people under Margaret Thatcher. The tax people were vicious. They were absolutely vicious in those days. They were bankrupting so many people. I said, "Well, when they bankrupted me, I said, do you want to take my furniture and everything?" They said, "We don't really want anything of yours. You haven't got anything that's worth enough money. If we did what we used to do, take people's furniture, we'd have warehouses full of it. We can't do it anymore." It was a terrible time.
We pick up the story as Eric tours the U.S. back in 1979 with his Stiff Records mates.
I came over in 78. After the second Stiff tour with Lena Lovitch, Rachel Sweet and Jonah Louie. I think Clive Davis wanted to buy Stiff Records, dump everything and just have Rachel Sweet, which I thought was short-sighted, really. And several other record labels were interested in bits of it. And I think everyone else got a deal with CBS or Epic, but no one wanted me. I was a bit too I was a bit much, I think. So they started Alan Fry, a man called Alan Fry, who had a company called ARSE, a management company that looked after me and looked after Nick Lowe and Elvis Costello over here. He started Stiff America, Stiff, like the American label, and it was just two kids in an office, in a little, tiny little office, packaging up records, and they were so enthusiastic and... came over and toured, and we had to do a tour in a school bus. It was a small school bus for picking up kids from outlying areas, and it had wooden seats and a heater under one of the seats, and we toured in November and December all across the States in this thing, and it was kind of hell, but it was the best thing that ever to happen.
But that was an era when you could come over with that level of success and do well across the country.
Well, we did. We sold loads of records. It was fun. So, of course, because I sold loads of records, suddenly I ended up on Epic Records.
Right.
And then started to get buried. We used to go along to gigs, and the opening act would have a window display in the record shop, and their dressing room would be full of journalists. And I'd be going, why don't I ever do any interviews? So we went to see Dick Wingate at Epic Records. You know, he's the man who put Bruce Springsteen on the map. So I found that quite impressive in some way. You know, I wanted to touch him to see if he was real or something like that. He said, is there any chance we could do a bit of promo? He said, didn't think you'd want to be bothered. I'm thinking, well, what do they think I'm doing? You know, just sleeping in a Ford Econoline van, going at 80 miles an hour between gigs, is some kind of bizarre holiday that they think I'm on. I mean, maybe they sensed that I didn't see it as a career like that, but I mean, I wanted to do all of it, but it was very bizarre being on Epic Records.
just because of things like that.
Yeah. I mean, suddenly it felt like I remember, like, they came to the bottom line. It was the day after my 26th birthday, and they bought a candle in with 26 a cake with 26 candles, and they said, okay, they lined up all these photographers, and they said, we've just got this corporate bullshit to get through. And I thought, well, that's nice. My birthday's turned into some corporate bullshit we've got to get through. And this condescending, patronising woman, they presented me with this cake, and I'm thinking, like, this is the most ridiculous thing. It's not even my birthday. And they said, OK, everybody ready? OK, and she looked at me, she said, blow out the candles. So I picked up a hairdryer and went, with the hairdryer. They were very unimpressed. They didn't get it. That was what being on Epic Records was like. It was serious.
Well, it was a punk, whatever, proto-punk label attached to a giant corporate label that was not about
music.
Yeah,
it was still very corporate, really. Yeah, and yeah. I just liked it when it was like two kids working out a thing, and all the deals was like, send cash, we'll send you the record, and we used to sell it at the gigs and stuff.
Reckless Eric is our guest, and you were talking about a lot about Joe Meeks and how he recorded, and I get a lot of that feeling from Bungalow High.
That's my last record that I did, yeah.
Do songs like that work the way you are set up today?
Yes, I can play you something off of that, which is quite nice because it's my upbringing again. It's a lot of it's a quality of life and upbringing, you know. I've watched lines and lines of railway lines blurring as they shoot past train windows. I've sat stationary on the motorways of this world, staring at discarded shoes. I want to carry a card, you know, just like a donor card that says, in the event of an accident, please take my shoes with me. I watched the traffic through yesterday's rain. I watched the neighborhood through distorted panes. I look at CD artwork scratchy grey plastic and see pictures of dinners on tins. I've been up, I've been down, I've spent a fortune in pubs, and I've bitten my nails to the quick. And if I've ever seen such a thing as life in the raw, it was wearing a polyester suit. See, I was brought up on brand, I was schooled in mundane. We never had fancy when brought up on hard up, schooled in forget it. We never knew different, we only knew same, 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 same. I gazed into a sink full of water the other night when I was stoned at home. Felt like I've been there forever. Stoned at home all alone. I've read reasons into sequences of things that went in threes. I see my future written in tea leaves, and I believe in make-believe. I read my stars, and I swallow every word. And when they're not so good, I twist them into something that's okay. I've spent half my life waiting for a bus that never came. I could have walked it by now, but it's possibly too late. I've worked on being stupid, cultivated mindlessness. I've given the wrong impression where appearances count, but I know exactly where I come from, though I've lied about where I've been. It's not that it's not good enough, it's just that it's no fun. See, I was brought up on bland, schooled in mundane. We never had fancy when we could have had plain. I was brought up on hard up, schooled in forget it. We never knew different, we only knew same, 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 same. Oh, 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 we knew same in the school of mundane, we knew same.
Reckless Eric is with us today on the World Cafe. That is a great song called Same from Bungalow High. Reckless Eric, who comes to shows nowadays? What kind of audiences do you get?
Well, it depends where. In America, it's all people who come to eat their dinner. No, that's something like I find very strange is that I'm walking into these places and it smells like a school canteen and there's all people sitting in front of you eating their dinner and I think, oh, these people eat before they come out, you know. It depends. It really depends. In England, I've been playing. I just did a tour before Christmas with The Damned, which was a ridiculous thing to do. I had to do it because it was, you know, I've never been into nostalgia. I've never been into reliving the old days. I always want to move on, do something new. But it was like sticking my head into the mouth of the nostalgia beast. And that was strange because there'd be all these middle-aged men there, you know, like shouting abuse. No, they weren't actually. They were very nice to me, but and miserable little goth girls who kind of leaned on the barrier and hated me all the way through my set because the only person they wanted to see was Dave Vanium. I sort of feel like there was a point where the kids would like the come along and like, I mean the people that came to see you would marry and have children and then they couldn't come because they couldn't get a babysitter and then they started to go out a bit after the kids had left home but now they can't go out because they've got to look after the grandchildren and like after that it's like we can't go out because we're too old and infirm and I always feel that I have this idea that I'm going to see out my retirement like playing at old people's homes and then like eventually I'm going to be playing a song that I wrote when I was on Stiff. There's a song called The Final Taxi and I'm going to make a damn good living playing that at funerals as long as it'll be tasteful enough to sort of demand some kind of fee for doing it because there are an awful lot of people who would like me to play that song at their funeral and I think there's a living in this. But I prefer to see the younger people. I don't mind who comes to see me, really.
I asked that question hoping that there was, because I thought it would go over with younger people, too. I thought that would be...
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. It has to be a combination, of course. Thank you so much for playing for us.
Thank you.
Reckless Eric.